وصحبته قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر.
Welcome to the August 10th edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly show hosted for many years by our beloved Sharif Fahm and continued in his memory by a group of his dedicated friends. Every week, This Week in Palestine brings you news and views from a distinctly Palestinian perspective, a perspective seldom heard in the United States. On today's show, we feature an interview with Israeli historian Ilan Pappe on the historical context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and Israel's policy of incremental genocide against the Palestinian people. The interview is courtesy of KPFA's talk show Voices of the Middle East and North Africa and was conducted on July 15th prior to the Israeli land invasion into the Gaza Strip. Stay tuned for another thought-provoking segment of This Week in Palestine, and we will start off with the weekly IMEMC news update.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, Gaza special coverage, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org. For August 2nd to the 8th, 2014. This week, Israeli attacks resumed after 3 days ceasefire ended without reaching any deal between Israeli and Palestinian delegation in Cairo. Death toll in Gaza has reached over 1,898, with no end to Israeli attacks on the coastal region. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. On Friday morning, the Israeli army resumed its air, sea and ground bombardment targeting the Gaza Strip. Up until the time of this report, 5 civilians, including a child, were killed and at least 11 other civilians were injured. Before the ceasefire took effect on Tuesday of this week, the Palestinian Health Ministry reported that Israeli attacks has left more than 1,898 killed and at least 9,800 injured. IMEMC's Ram El-Mighari with updates from Gaza.
Israeli airstrikes resumed in different parts of Gaza, and no one can predict what's going next. What the upcoming hours will bear for the whole population in the Gaza Strip, and it seems there is an escalation in the ground that is gradual and sort of deliberate. That's what we can understand out of this. Escalation that seems to be deliberate by both sides, actually, which means that both sides are apparently pressuring each other into accepting a longer-term truce based on each's conditions. The people always look forward to real changes their lives in the Gaza Strip. And the demands of the resistance are the same demands of the people here. The demands that are very clear, ending the siege, allowing the Gaza fishermen to have, or allowing the Gaza Strip to have a seaport, a little or a small seaport, reconstructing the international airport of Gaza, that has been long destroyed and abandoned.
The latest wave of Israeli attacks came shortly after a 3 days ceasefire was mediated by Egypt and gave way for indirect talks between Palestinian and Israeli officials hosted by Cairo. Palestinian official Azam Al-Ahmad, leading the Palestinian delegation in Cairo, announced on Thursday that no extension of the ceasefire was reached. Representative of Al-Qassam Brigades, Abu Ubaidah, stated on Thursday that no extension of ceasefire if Israel does not accept the Palestinian demands.
We strongly believe our demands do not need negotiations. They are humanitarian rights, basic rights, guaranteed by international law. And therefore, we call on the Palestinian negotiators not to accept any extension of ceasefire without achieving our legitimate demands. If our demands are met, we can extend the truce and then hold talks on details.
Israel refused Palestinian demands such as lifting the 8-year-long Israeli siege on Gaza, halt of all Israeli attacks on the coastal region, and establishing a seaport and airport in Gaza. Palestinian political analyst Ghassan Andoni spoke to IMEMC.
Israel understood that this truce is paving the way for a long talk about the request of the resistance in Gaza. I think the Israeli approach includes that with time, the pressure will mount on the resistance in Gaza because of the human condition, and finally will force them to knee on the Israeli conditions. And I think that was a trap. And this is why, in my opinion, it was wise from a political point of view for the resistance not to accept a continued extension of the truce.
The Palestinian resistance demands are constant with the terms of the Oslo Accords, local sources reported. The agreement was jointly signed between Israeli and Palestinian officials in the 1990s, but Israel has failed to abide and continues to publicly denounce armed Palestinian groups as a terrorist organization. Elsewhere, Israeli army forces conducted night invasions targeting communities all over the West Bank all week long. On Friday, Israeli troops shot and killed a Palestinian teenager during Gaza solidarity protests organized in Albira town in central West Bank. Such protests were reported in the southern West Bank cities of Bethlehem and Hebron. Many residents were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Earlier in the week, an 8-year-old child was seriously injured after being rammed by an Israeli settler's vehicle in the old city of Hebron in the southern part of the West Bank. The boy suffered serious injury and was moved to the Hebron Governmental Hospital. According to witnesses, the child was deliberately attacked while walking near the main street of the old city of Hebron. And that's all for today from This Week in Palestine, Gaza special coverage. This was the weekly report for August 2nd to the 8th, 2014. From the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This week's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan. On this edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa,
ethnic cleansing can be implemented in kind of two contradictory ways, but they complement each other. The best option is, of course, if you want to ethnically cleanse an area, is to depopulate it, to push the people out. But sometimes you can't do it. So you enclave them, you imprison them, you don't allow them to move. And that's kind of the second best option, but you get the same result.
We will be talking with Ilan Pape, Professor of History and Director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter, and the author of the seminal book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, about how to place the latest Israeli military assault on Gaza in the wider historical context. Stay with us. Since the beginning of the Israeli military assault on Gaza over a week ago, over 200 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,400 have been wounded. And at least 17,000 people have taken refuge in the UN compounds in Gaza. In a recent opinion piece in the Electronic Intifada, Israeli historian Ilan Pape defines the Israeli policy towards the Gaza Strip as an incremental genocide. He writes, quote, "Israel's present assault on Gaza, alas, indicates that this policy continues unabated. The term is important since it appropriately locates Israel's barbaric action then and now within a wider historical context," I reached Professor Pape at his home in Haifa.
Ilan, I wanted to start with what's leading in the news right now, the proposal by Egypt for a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. According to news reports, there is no mention of the opening of the Rafah border crossing or the payments of the salaries of government workers in Gaza, 40,000 employees, or release of prisoners who were rearrested in recent extensive sweep in the West Bank, following the kidnapping and killing of the three settler teenagers. And the news is that the one-sided ceasefire is off and Israel has continued dropping its bombs on Gaza. So first off, what do you think about this proposal and the timing of it?
I think the proposal is another ploy to try and to at least weaken the Hamas presence in Gaza and its ability to resist, if not to try and gradually wipe it out altogether. The difference between this ploy and the previous one is that, of course, the Egyptian government this time is a full accomplice in this tactic. The idea is the following, that you disregard altogether why the Hamas had started this campaign, and you sort of force it to admit that it has no military power to resist unilateral Israeli plans, this time backed by Egypt. And the most important plan, I think, is to condition some lifting or lifting some of the restriction on the Strip in return for weakening the Hamas political power there. For instance, one of the major things the Israelis and the Egyptians want is to replace the Egyptian border police on the Rafah crossing with PA police there, and so on. So in other words, it's an attempt to, in a way, to trick the Hamas into ending its resistance for nothing, actually, for nothing, without forcing Israel to at least retract from the main steps it had carried out in the West Bank, which was the immediate background for this wave of violence.
Do you think there is also a pressure by the U.S. and the Europeans on Israel to somehow stop this latest attack on Gaza?
Yes, there could be a more naive reading into it by Europeans and Americans, and even the United Nations, saying, well, the most important thing is to end fighting unconditionally, which seems on the face of it a very reasonable demand in any place where blood is being shed. But in this respect, you're sort of totally ignoring why there is fire at the first place. And my guess is if the Hamas would have received a proper invitation from the Egyptian to negotiate a ceasefire, explaining to them that there is now a scope for negotiating some of their basic demands, I very little doubt that the Hamas would have accepted the ceasefire. They're not opposed to the ceasefire in principle. They've accepted ceasefire proposals in the past. But I think they very cleverly understood that this time it's a trap. It's not a genuine call for ceasefire. It's almost like a propaganda campaign that is meant to destroy them by other means than the military ones.
It's been used as a pretext again by the Israeli government and Netanyahu to bomb Gaza even more.
Absolutely, which is always the case in this history of the Israeli oppression and occupation here. You have a situation by which you see the Israelis make unreasonable demands or act in a way that requires the other side to react, and then using that reaction as a pretext for implementing a far more long-term strategy. And the long-term strategy here is really a willingness to keep the Gaza Strip as a huge ghetto, as a huge prison, a domiciled one, and if it is not quiet, to bomb it to death without any inhibition. And the fact that now you have a government in Egypt that seems to care far less than any previous government in the history of Egypt about the fate of the people in Gaza, it's even easier to see how any Israeli military action becomes a genocidal operation, given the geopolitical conditions in which the Gaza Strip exists.
That's exactly what I wanted to talk to you about. In a recent piece in the Electronic Intifada titled Israel's Incremental Genocide in the Gaza Ghetto, you write that Israel's latest military aggression against the 1.8 million Palestinians living in Gaza should be really understood within a wider historical context. So can we step back? Can you talk about what is the historical context within which we should understand this latest assault and the ones before? Because this is like the third one in the past 6 years or so.
Yeah, that's right. I think the best point of departure, without going too much into details, is actually occupation of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank by Israel in June 1967. The occupation of these two territories was in many ways the completion of the geographical ambition of the Zionist movement to take over the whole of historical Palestine, and this was achieved in June 67. The problem was, of course, that in the additional territories, there was a large number of Palestinians, and there was always a parallel Zionist ambition, which was not only to have the territory, but to have it as exclusively a Jewish space. And the fact that after 67, you now had millions of Palestinians within that Jewish space created a huge problem for the ideology of Zionism and the strategic vision of the State of Israel. Mm-hmm. Now, in the West Bank, throughout the years, the Israelis found a solution for that problem. Time will tell whether they succeed in it, and the Palestinians have twice revolted against this strategy and may do it again. But from an Israeli perspective, it looked feasible to take the West Bank and in a way divide it into two areas that Israel is going to gradually annex to Israel and cleanse the areas from the Palestinian population there, and areas which are densely populated by Palestinians, they would be controlled from the outside, and a kind of a return for a Palestinian good behavior could be defined even as a Palestinian state. And we have seen this throughout the history. The Gaza Strip doesn't offer a space for such a maneuver. You can't divide it into two. They tried it, the Israelis, until 2005, as you know. 30% of the Gaza Strip was controlled by the settlers. 70% into the rest of the 70%, almost 2 million Palestinians were pushed. And this didn't work, and Sharon decided in 2005 that it's much better to ghettoize the whole of the Gaza Strip and take the settlers outside. Mm-hmm. And from that moment onwards, there were only two options for the Israelis. They could not do what they did in the West Bank. So
basically, yeah. What you're saying, the Israelis' long-term policies of ethnic cleansing and population transfer in the West Bank and Jerusalem was not possible in the Gaza Strip.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's a good point you're making, because ethnic cleansing can be implemented in kind of two contradictory ways, but they complement each other. Mm-hmm. The best option is, of course, if you want to ethnically cleanse an area, is to depopulate it, to push the people out. But sometimes you can't do it. So you enclave them, you imprison them, you don't allow them to move. And that's kind of a second best option, but you get the same result. Because they can't move, because they're ghettoized or enclaved or imprisoned, they are not part of the demographic account as far as you are concerned. In the Gaza Strip, this was what was attempted by Sharon with the Gaza Strip. In 2005, actually, Israel already started it. People forget this. From 1994, actually, the Gaza Strip was already cordoned, mm-hmm. not by a wall, but by barbed wire. And Israel already controlled the food, medicine, and material that went into the Gaza Strip from 1994 onwards.
And this is a post-Oslo Accord.
The post-Oslo Accord and the Oslo Accord, which explains the Second Intifada, when people realize the gap between the discourse of peace and the oppressive reality that this so-called peace created on the ground. But it worked for a while, because the Israelis were happy with the PA control in the Gaza Strip. So this was a kind of an open prison, if you want, but still a prison. But in 2005, the inmates, if one can call it this way, using the same metaphor of the prison, had enough. and rebelled against this strangulation and ghettoization by starting a resistance movement. And the Israelis turned the open prison into a maximum security prison, which they bomb from the outside whenever they feel like or whenever the rebellion is too much for them. And because they can't divide the Gaza Strip to areas A, B, and C as they do in the West Bank. They can't hope that the Palestinians would move to Egypt as they hope that they would move from the West Bank to Jordan. And they know, I'm sure they know, they're fully conscious that if they don't allow these people to be united with the rest of Palestine, if they do not check out, expel all these people, they leave them at their mercy in this huge prison which is called the Gaza Strip. And once this prison rebels, they are the strongest army in the area, if not in the world. Mm-hmm. They use the weapons that were made originally for fighting brigades of tanks and hundreds of thousands of soldiers, and they use it on an urban space of a small city in America. So this is how it becomes genocidal. So it doesn't matter, in a way, what would be the result of the present ceasefire, if it will materialize. The thing is that the basic situation has not changed. And I have a feeling, but I'm not saying it out of knowledge, this is my feeling, that there is a deeper recognition among the Hamas military wing people that this is the reality. I think for the first time, I think they absorbed that reality. And this is why, contrary to all what the commentaries are saying, but I'm very careful here because I don't know, mm-hmm, I'm guessing, mm-hmm, most of the commentators say this is the last show of force, what the Hamas is doing here, and they would like to, you know, to enter more forcefully into the ceasefire negotiation. It's a possibility that what they're doing now is trying to be in a better negotiating position. Yeah. But I have my doubts. I think the Hamas are now actually exhausting their missile reservoir in a way that really empties it. Not the Israelis are not destroying it very successfully, but the Hamas is wasting it, if you want. And I think they feel like, and this must be their feeling, they have nothing to lose. They really have nothing to lose. It's not that if they stop the fire, the Gaza Strip is going to be released or liberated. The ghetto would continue to starve and be strangulated by Israel if the ceasefire would be just a ceasefire and not a departure point for ending the Israeli siege over the Gaza Strip. And I think what the Hamas realizes is that neither Egypt, nor Europe, neither the United States or Israel are looking at the ceasefire as a departure point for ending the siege. And in that situation, I'm not surprised that they see very little options but, at least for the time being, to continue the fighting unless someone would offer them something better.
So if Hamas is in a weaker position, wouldn't that put them even in a worse place in getting their demands, or at least some of their demands, in a possible negotiation with Israel?
It's a very interesting philosophical question. I think we all need to reconceptualize our understanding of Palestine. The kind of national struggle we were all thinking about has been lost. That is, a proper military struggle or armed struggle to liberate Palestine is a thing of the past. It had its successes. The main success was to keep the Palestinian National Movement alive, but it also has its failures. It didn't liberate one square inch of Palestine. And I think what we are going into now is a very different phase. I would dare and call it a post-national phase. And in this phase, Israel is becoming again the ruler of the whole of Palestine. And the way it operates against the Palestinians in that new old Palestine would be judged by the international community eventually, not by the present political elites who don't dare to do anything, but by their societies, which may impact the political elites later. In other words, it's far worse for the Gaza Strip in a way to be in a situation it was before that operation than to be in a situation where Israel clearly is exposed as the ones who hold the key for electricity, food, survival, and so on. And this is a kind of a situation where really the Hamas has very little to lose in this respect, in terms of the balance of power on the ground. Again, I'm not saying everyone in Hamas is thinking that way.
Yeah,
maybe
yeah.
Some of them are really feel energized and empowered by the fact that so many Israelis have to run to shelter, and that they have reached a destination that even the Hezbollah didn't reach in 2006. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm not an expert, and I don't try to. Yeah. I don't believe in deciphering the minds of others. But I'm saying that the Hamas and the Fatah are on an historical junction, and that historical junction would force them both A, to unite, and B, to strategize in a different way, a different kind of struggle from the ones that they have conducted until now. The PA could not continue with the charade of diplomacy, and Hamas would have to look for another way, I think, than the missiles way. Mm. But that's a very difficult decision to take. It really brings forth the idea that there is one state in Israel and Palestine, and you need to think about the civil, non-violent popular struggle to change the regime, as it was done eventually in South Africa.
And especially when the place is hermetically sealed.
Absolutely, exactly.
And that's Ilan Pape, who is a professor of history and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter. We're talking about the context within which we should understand and analyze the Israeli military aggression against the people of Gaza. Ilan, a few years ago, Dara Lee, who's an anthropologist, published a paper in the Journal of Palestine Studies in which he writes, "First, the Gaza Strip is a space where Israel tests and refines various techniques of management, continuously experimenting in search of an optimal balance between maximum control over the territory and minimum responsibility for its non-Jewish population. Second, just as laboratory experiments are meant to be replicated elsewhere, the territory is a sort of proving ground for practices that could become increasingly relevant in the West Bank if Palestinian life there is fragmented into an archipelago of isolated Gaza Strip. And third, he says, because the Gaza Strip represents a stage of concentration and segregation that is unprecedented in the conflict, it can be seen as a space in which, quote-unquote, the pure conditions of laboratory experimentation are best approximated."
I think it's definitely part of the picture. I think there are different lobbies within Israel that have different agendas when it comes to the Gaza Strip. But I think there's an overarching strategy, which is not that the one that was mentioned. Mm-hmm. I do agree, and there was an excellent documentary film, and I don't know if your listeners have seen it. If not, I strongly recommend a thing called The Lab by Yotam Feldman, an Israeli director. The Lab shows that both in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, you can see a correlation between Israeli operations on the one hand, and the need to test new Israeli weapons on the other. Sometimes at the request of customers from the outside, not only superpowers who have similar issues like the United States, but also by police, like the death squads that kill people in the pueblos in Brazil, because it's a similar kind of fighting environment or combat environment. So definitely this is part of it. But I think, you know, these agendas do not exist by themselves. They are derived and are inspired by a far more important agenda. And that agenda was best described, in a way, in a June 67 meeting by the Israeli government, when they had to decide what they want to do with the West Bank and the Gaza Strip after they had occupied it. And they said very clearly about the West Bank, this is ancient Israel, we will never give it back, we just have to find the right charade of peace so that the world will not pressure us to withdraw from our homeland. But what about the Gaza Strip, they asked. And the Prime Minister and the Finance Minister at the time used the same language about Gaza. They said it's a pit of snakes, and a pit of snakes has to be controlled and every now and then destroyed. This dehumanization of the people, the vast majority of them refugees expelled from Israel in 1948, by the way. That's why it's so dense, right? Gaza was beautiful until 1948, very nicely and spacious and connected to the sea and everything around it. But after 1948, it became a huge refugee camp. And the Israelis dehumanized it, and that brings the laboratory and the weapon experiments into it. Not the wish to experiment with the weapons. But the dehumanization of the Gaza area, not as a place where human beings live, but a place which is a sore kind of point where you cannot use all the techniques you have so successfully used elsewhere in the Galilee and the Nakab and in the West Bank, because you, despite your wish to ethnically cleanse a Palestinian country, you still left with a large number of Palestinians under your control. And everywhere else, apart from Gaza, you know what to do with them. But you don't know what to do within the Gaza Strip, so you dehumanize it, and either you forget about it because nothing happens there. People don't mind being starved, people don't mind being locked, or if they rebel, then you use your air force, your navy, and your army. And for an Israeli strategist, this is life. This is not a problem. It becomes part of the DNA. That's what you do every few years with the Gaza Strip. And that's just so horrific and barbaric about it. People keep talking about the Hamas as sort of representing something very primitive, something very cruel and brutal, because they're easily associated with the horrible things we're seeing in Iraq and in Syria. But contrary to Iraq and Syria, people don't talk about where do they come from, what originated the kind of resistance that they're using, and it's not the worst kind of resistance, one should say, compared to many other methods used by liberation movements in the 50s and the 60s to try and decolonize the country. But the most important thing is to understand what we are seeing here from the perspective of human rights and civil rights. This is an area which Israel decided that international law, human rights, and civil rights do not apply to. And therefore, you can experiment with weapons there as well.
Mm. So their short-term goal is basically to quiet them, the Palestinians, and the long-term goal is to have some sort of a regulated level of violence. But necessarily, just because Israel wants to do that, it doesn't mean that they have been or are going to be successful in implementing their policies.
No, of course not. There are two additional aspects here. One, very early on, the Israelis understood that areas like Gaza would not be quiet forever and would not be quiet always. So they settled the North African Jews there, and now the Ethiopian Jews, and the less fortunate Russian Jews. And they've pushed them all on the border of the Gaza Strip. So they are the main victims whenever the Hamas has the power to show its resistance. And I think that this kind of social marginalization would not be tolerated by that kind of population forever. We already see the signs for that. That's one aspect. And the second one is that the failure of the peace process, which is the most important thing, and the death of the two-state solution. I think the foiled Kerry initiative now does not only dim the differences between the Gaza Strip and those areas in the West Bank, Area A, according to the Oslo Accord, which are supposedly independent Palestinian enclaves but are controlled in the same way as the Gaza Strip is controlled, but they also dim the differences between the Gaza Strip and the West Bank and the Nakab and the Galilee inside Israel and Wadi Ara, all the areas where Palestinians live in them. The Israelis themselves are employing more and more the same strategy, tactics, and methods against the Palestinians all over Palestine, wherever they are, whether they are Israeli citizens, whether they are citizenless citizens in the West Bank or inmates in the Gaza ghetto. And I think the uniformity of that Israeli policy would eventually trigger a more uniform Palestinian response. To my humble opinion, the more this new uniformed coordinated policy would be based on human rights and civil rights and less on national rights, the more successful it will be. But I could fully understand my Palestinian friends who still believe either in a national or religious agenda. I just don't think it will work. Mm. I really think that depicting the struggle in Israel as a struggle between oppressed, colonized natives and a third generation of settlers who have not finished the job as far as they are concerned with the indigenous people is the best way of redirecting or changing the world, the global understanding about what goes on here. Mm. Because for 66 years, the world decided this is a typical conflict between two national movements, which serves the Israelis very well. and totally disadvantage and disempower the Palestinians. This is not a struggle between two national movements. It's the last anti-colonialist struggle we have in the 21st century, which is makes it so difficult to understand. But this is the kind of struggle that, if it is framed as a struggle for human rights and civil rights and collective rights, would correspond to many things that decent people around the world do not would identify with. And I think it's a long-term project, but still possible one.
What are you seeing in terms of other creative tactics Palestinians are using to resist the occupation?
I think what they have is a cyberspace, which is very interesting to follow for the younger generation. And remember, the Gaza population is extremely, extremely young. The vast majority of people in the Gaza Strip are young people. And there is a beginning of a virtual community developing between Palestinians wherever they are, even if they don't have the physical opportunity to meet. And I read some of this correspondence. And there is, it's very naive sometimes, very utopian, very idealist, but there's something there. I can see the grains of something very different.
One thing that I have noticed also on Twitter especially, the Palestinian activists, journalists, doctors have really engaged the Zionists, the pro-Israeli individuals that are posting, tweeting.
That's right.
And also it's really interesting for me to see some of these journalists are so active in debunking and unpacking the Western media coverage of what is going on in Gaza.
But I'm also talking about something which for me is the most important event that nobody paid attention to because it's very small. And it's just an indicator. It's not important by itself, but it's important.
And that's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632. Email voomekpfa@yahoo.com. Connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio. Please join us next time for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
They used to see it as a local struggle. It has nothing to do with Palestine altogether. And all these mini struggles against acts of depopulation, expropriation of land, discrimination, so on, are now seen as part of the same ideology, or the result of the same ideology, and also an agenda for the same struggle. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about a process that just begins. It hasn't matured yet. Mm-hmm. It will take time, but the Israelis will help it. Will help it because of the strategic decision that they have made of putting aside the issue of democracy as marginal and not so important, and just keeping the American support at bay, and that's what counts. And the cynical EU, Indian, and Chinese leadership at bay as well.
And where do you see the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movements against Israeli occupation within this struggle?
Well, I think the BDS in many ways was the precursors of what I'm saying. Hmm. It has turned the struggle for Palestine into a civil and human rights issue. It proved that when you frame the Palestinian struggle as a human rights and civil rights issue, you immediately galvanize a support Palestine never had before in the international community, and you leave the Israelis without any good answers to the questions that are being asked. Mm. Secondly, it is very clear that if there is no peace process, and if the reason that there is no peace process is the Israeli wish to have it all, it becomes more and more legitimate, not only in the eyes of activists and groups within the civil society, but even among politicians. I think the BDS is a kind of, and sometimes people don't understand me because in a way it appeared a bit prematurely, but now it becomes more and more relevant as the years pass by. It's the kind of refinement that we needed, or fine-tuning that we needed to the orientation of the Palestinian struggle. It's not an alternative to a national leadership, national struggle, and so on, but it gives it a fine-tuning. And that fine-tuning puts the struggle for freedom in Israel and Palestine on the same pedestal as a struggle for freedom against apartheid in South Africa, which didn't happen before. Mm-hmm. And I think that the BDS is really the kind of alternative that people would say, well, it's an alternative we cannot object to. We may object to a missile. We may object to a suicide bomb. We may doubt the wisdom of people trying desperate means of resistance, but we cannot really object to this. And that's why I don't understand the colleagues of ours and friends of ours who came so strongly against it without, I think, paying enough attention to the importance of this.
We're running out of time, but I just want to ask you a couple of more questions.
Okay.
There are more instances of right-wing groups attacking Palestinian citizens of Israel and also attacking Israelis who have been protesting against the assault on Gaza.
That's right.
So we've talked about this before on the program with you. The anti-Palestinian racist sentiments are nothing new, but it seems to be getting more attention this time around. Do you get the same sense?
Oh, yes. I think it's part of what we were talking about before. Namely, the more even Israelis, let alone people outside of Israel, realize that the old idea of the two-state solution, the old notions that were the basis for the peace process evaporate, disappear, are not relevant anymore, the clearer you get the vision of the junction in which the Israeli society stands. And there are only two ways. There are only two ways in that junction, two possible ways forward. One is to turn into, if you want, a proper apartheid state, legally, morally, with the brutal and ugly kind of mob support from below to such a structure, which means more and more attacks on Palestinians, wherever they are, by people who think that that's what the government would like them to do, although it will never say so, right? We know that from history. Fascism and Nazism and apartheid always had, and some brutal regimes in South America, had this additional kind of layer of violence by vigilantes from the oppressive society, believing, and sometimes rightly so, that the government condones what they're doing. So that's one way. Politically, this is the way Israel is going, so it seems. Of course, there's another option, which is to build a democratic society for all and begin to respect human rights and civil rights. This is not in the offering as far as the Jewish community is concerned, but this is something the world can pressure Israel to do, as it did in the case of South Africa.
In the Western media, the racism towards Palestinians, whether it's coming from the official channels or from the right-wing groups, it has been quite normalized.
Oh, yes, it's been legalized almost.
And there have been also attacks on Palestinian protesters in France, in the U.S.
Yes, but I think there's a difference between the nature of the attacks inside Israel and Palestine and the attacks in Europe and in America. In Europe and in America, I think the attacks are far more out of despair because they have lost the moral ground, the moral argument. So they will resort more and more to violence, it's true. But that's, unfortunately, it's unfortunate to say it, but it's a good sign. It really means that they don't have any way of presenting, despite the fact that they are injecting millions and millions of money into a propaganda machine, there's no way of winning this propaganda war. In Israel, the violence is different. It doesn't come out of desperation. It comes out of almost a relief. Now we are really licensed to be a racist state. We play the charade of being a Jewish democracy, but there's no need for it anymore. That's unfortunately the sort of prevalent mood now in the country. And that's, in the short run, it's very, very dangerous for those at the receiving end of these kinds of brutalities. In the midterm or even long term, it helps to call a spade with the hope that this would convince enough people, first of all in the outside world and then in the inside, for the need for a drastic change of regime and the very ideological infrastructure of the state.
¶¶
Ilan Pape is a professor of history and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter and the author of the new book, The Idea of Israel, A History of Power and Knowledge. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
And this concludes another edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly segment here on 90.3 FM WZBC Newton. It's part of Truth and Justice Radio, which happens every Sunday from 6 to 10 a.m. We hope you'll join us again for news and views from and about Palestine.